My burden for and commitment to human rights goes back 50 years from when I was at university and we campaigned against apartheid in South Africa and communism in Eastern Europe and other countries where fascism was dominant. And that burden for those who were suffering, oppressed, persecuted has been an important thread in my faith and in my ministry for those 45, 50 years. I retired from the Church of England 6 years ago, and friends helped set up a charity, a UK charity called Peacemakers, Peacemaker Trust, to enable me to carry on advocating for justice, peace, and reconciliation in various parts of the world. But we particularly seek to be catalysts where minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied, where human rights are suppressed, or reconciliation is needed. And there is nowhere perhaps that's more torn, suffered, abused from human rights abuses than Palestine. It's been the subject of more UN resolutions than any other issue in the world. It's been the longest running dispute in the hands of the United Nations. And if we can get Jews, Muslims, and Christians to find a just and lasting peace in Palestine, that will have a ripple effect in many other countries.
Going back to the title of this interview, Christian Zionism, could you walk us through what is Christian Zionism?
Well, Christian Zionism is simply Christian support for Zionism, the belief. Zionism was a secular movement. The belief that they wanted self-determination, the right to create their own state, their own free from persecution and pogrom. But Christian Zionism puts the religious dimension into the whole equation. And what's not well known is that Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism by at least 50 years. If the term Zionism was developed in the 1880s, you can't call it Christian Zionism before 1880, but you can call it Christian Restorationism, restoring the Jews to Palestine. So the main advocates for Zionism were Christian leaders. And today, 9 out of 10 Zionists in the world are Christians. So it preceded Jewish Zionism and it dominates Zionism today. But we can date it quite clearly to 1799, when Napoleon became the first world ruler in 2,000 years to promise the Jews a homeland. He was not being altruistic. He was fighting the British, and he wanted the Jewish bankers and he wanted the Jewish community to support the French against the British. And he became, as I said, the first world ruler to try and assist the Jews to take Palestine as the bridge between Europe, Asia, and Africa. It became a strategic location geopolitically. But Napoleon was unable to achieve that. Britain defeated France, and Britain became interested in the same geopolitical agenda of using the Jews within the British Empire to help defeat the Ottomans, to control the Middle East on Britain's behalf. That movement really began in the 1820s, 1830s. But as I said, it was Christian leaders who were very influential in facilitating opportunities for Zionist leaders to meet with kings, queens and prime ministers of the European states, lobbying them to help the Jews take Palestine. But it would have been in the context of allowing the Jews to live in the British Empire. We weren't giving land away to anyone. We were still building our empire. So what the Jews were looking for was not necessarily what the British were willing to give them. And as you may know, the Balfour Declaration, which was Britain's promise to the Jews, was a three-way promise. We promised the Jews a homeland, we promised to protect the rights of the Muslims and the Arabs, but we'd already promised the French we were going to keep it to ourselves, the secret Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1915. So we promised it three ways. And as you know, if you promise something to three different groups of people, you can't please them all.
Yes.
And during the 20th century, both the Zionist movement and the Arab nationalists realized that Britain was being duplicitous, mm-hmm. that we were not going to fulfill the promises we'd made. So both attacked Britain. Mm-hmm. Britain developed the partition plan as our exit strategy out of Palestine, leaving it to the Zionists and the Arabs to fight each other mm-hmm. over the land. So it was a very cynical mm-hmm. A plan. And we're living with the consequences of that partition plan today.
Mm-hmm. Up until now. And just now you mentioned about, so the prominent figures in the movement is actually the Christian leaders itself. So why do Christians has become the pro-supporters of Israel?
Well, it has a lot to do with geopolitics. And in the 19th century and early 20th century, the dominant world powers were Britain, France, Germany, Russia, America. But the dominant ones were Britain and France, mm-hmm. having defeated Germany in the First World War. Again, the Balfour Declaration was published to preempt a German promise. The Germans were after the Zionists to mm-hmm. help the Germans beat the British, mm-hmm. but Britain got in first. But as Britain's control, as you know, here in Malaysia and other countries, declined yes. with the rise of nationalism all over the world that wanted to be liberated from the British Empire or the French Empire or whatever, mm-hmm. the US took over that dominant role. And as we're going to explore later in this conversation, the theology of Christian Zionism permeated quite significantly in the United States mm-hmm. and helped shape US foreign policy vis-a-vis the Middle East. Mm-hmm. If we remember with the Russian Revolution, 1918, and the rise of communism, the presence of a Western supporting nation in the Middle East was strategic. Mm-hmm. To have American Jews and European Jews yes. living in Israel was seen as a vital way of pushing back the communist influence that was mm-hmm. influencing the Arab world, not just Eastern Europe and other countries. Mm-hmm. So America became the main champion of Zionism, partly out of self-interest, helping to limit the extent of communism. And as communism declined, the rise of Islamism and the we factor in oil and mm-hmm. the presence of oil in the Gulf and in Syria and other parts of the Middle East. Again, it becomes a strategic factor mm-hmm. Maintaining a pro-Western presence in Palestine in the shape of the State of Israel.
In your opinion, what is their influence in the current Israel's aggression towards Gaza?
The attitude of Christian Zionists toward what's happening in Gaza is based on their worldview of what they believe God is doing in Israel today. Mm-hmm. And so if we take a step back and think about what they actually believe, then we can put Gaza in that context. Mm-hmm. Typically, Christian Zionists hold to seven basic tenets of belief. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily all in the same extent, mm-hmm. but they're all there. The fundamental one is it goes right back to the story of Abraham in the book of Genesis, where God made a promise to Abraham, I will make you, your descendants, as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore, and through your seed all nations on earth will be blessed. Mm-hmm. And promises like that have been manipulated to suggests that when God mentions seed, he means Israel, the seed meaning the children of Abraham. And so the core belief within Christian Zionism is that the Jews are God's chosen people, mm-hmm. separate from everyone else, including Christians. Put them on a pedestal, mm-hmm. that the Jews are God's chosen people. And then that moves on to the land. The belief that the Jews are being returned to their land, the mm-hmm. land that God gave to the Jews exclusively from the river of Egypt, probably the Nile, or at least the brook in Gaza, through to the Euphrates, mm-hmm. which is most of the Middle East.
Yes.
So They are the chosen people. They get the promised land. Jerusalem is their exclusive capital. The temple must be rebuilt before Jesus can return. There will be a war of Armageddon, a conflict between Christians and Jews on one side, with God on their side, and Muslims and other faiths on the other side. These are the basic tenets of Christian Zionism. Mm-hmm. So when we come to what's happened in Gaza, it's merely an extent of that. Mm-hmm. It dehumanizes the Palestinians. They are equated with the Philistines, the Amalekites. Mm-hmm. It's why Netanyahu quoted the Bible in relation to Gaza, because he's appealing to his Christian Zionist lobby to support him in what he's about to do. Mm-hmm. So you elevate the Jews, the Zionists, and then you denigrate the Palestinians. So mm-hmm. that kind of justifies their persecution. But if you believe God gave all of the land to the Jewish people, then you can't allow others to have that land. So Gaza would be regarded as part of Israel, and mm-hmm. therefore you would find sympathy for what Israel's doing. Mm-hmm. It may balk at news of women and children being bombed and mm-hmm. hospitals being bombed and so on, but their deepest conviction would be, well, this land belongs to the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the previous question, is there any biblical prophecy about the Palestine? And why do the Christian Zionism interpret the Bible verses differently from the others?
Well, there are lots of Bible prophecies. In Scripture, God has given promises and predicted things would happen because God is outside of time. Mm-hmm. The problem we have is interpreting those prophecies. Mm-hmm. And the temptation throughout history has always been what we would call chronological arrogance, mm-hmm. the belief that our generation is the one that the Bible is talking about. Mm-hmm. We are the most important ones, and therefore the Bible is coming true in our day. Mm-hmm. Not in the past and not in the future. We're blinkered. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to see, as we look back in history, to how those promises or those prophecies were misunderstood. I mean, I'll give you one example. There was a famous book published in 1987, and it was called 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Returning in 1988. Well, Jesus didn't return in 1988, and they didn't bother with a second edition of the book. But in the late 19th and early 20th century, Christian Zionism became very popular mm-hmm. because the pastors, the authors, had the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other, mm-hmm. and they put the two together. So, for example, at the rise of the movement, there was speculation: is Napoleon the Antichrist? You know, the demon figure, uh-huh. because he was opposing Christians, he was persecuting the church in France. Mm-hmm. And then, when Napoleon wasn't the Antichrist, is it communism? Because again, they're persecuting the church. So there have been many failed interpretations of prophecy. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question specifically, God did promise the Jews the right to live in God's land. Mm-hmm. He never gave them the land. He never gave them the freehold. He gave them leasehold. Uh-huh. Freehold is when you pay for a piece of land and it's yours, mm-hmm. and then you build a house on it. Mm-hmm. Leasehold is where you don't own the land, you rent it, mm-hmm. and you build a house and you pay rent to the person who owns the land. Mm-hmm. The Bible emphasizes, God says, the land is mine and you are aliens and strangers in my land. So where Zionism goes wrong is that it says, no, the land is ours. Mm-hmm. But God's word says, no, the land is mine. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Ishmael, they were all aliens and strangers because God had prepared something better for them and us, which is heaven. Mm-hmm. Earth is a temporary residence.
Yes.
So the idea that we can hang on to it is laughable, really, in terms of eternity. Mm-hmm. So there is no promise in Scripture that insists the Jews have an exclusive right to the land or a permanent right to the land. Mm-hmm. They were often warned, obey and you can stay, mm-hmm. rebel and you're out. So the history of the Jewish people is a constant exile from the land when they rebelled against God. Mm-hmm. When they came back, they were told to share it, to share the inheritance with mm-hmm. the foreigners living among you. Mm-hmm. So the emphasis of the Hebrew scriptures particularly is that the land was to be shared by all people of faith.
Mm-hmm. And going to the seventh question, we would like to touch a bit on the Christianity, the relationship between Christianity and also Judaism. So does Christian rely on Judaism, and do they have any relationship between?
Yes, there is. The relationship is chronological.
Mm-hmm.
The foundation of the Christian faith is the Jewish faith. In the same way, to some extent, the Muslim faith historically draws upon the history of God's people,
mm-hmm.
Beginning with Genesis. The pivotal or key doctrine or truth within Christianity is the recognition of Jesus as the Messiah,
mm-hmm.
as the one promised in the Hebrew Scriptures who would deliver God's people and would save us from evil and from the evil one. So we read the Hebrew Scriptures mm-hmm. through the eyes of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we, you know, you take a lump of cheese and mm-hmm. use a cheese grater.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's still cheese, but yes. it comes out differently.
Yes.
So the way that a Jewish rabbi would interpret the Hebrew Scriptures is not the same way a Christian theologian would, because we read it through the teachings of Jesus, through the Gospels and the interpretation in the epistles. So there is a continuity chronologically,
mm-hmm.
but the emphasis is that we see Jesus in the Hebrew Scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
In, for example, when Abraham offered Isaac, the way that Jews understand it, we see the request to sacrifice Isaac as a picture
mm-hmm.
of God sacrificing his son in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The Isaiah, book of Isaiah, talks about the suffering servant. Again, we see that person as Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The ransom sacrifice, the Passover lamb, the kinsman redeemer. These are all images that God put into the Hebrew Scriptures to show how he was going to rescue us from evil. And we believe he achieved that through mm-hmm. through Jesus. So there's a continuity rather than a discontinuity. Now, Zionists mm-hmm. like to claim the promises of the Hebrew Scriptures and don't like the way that they're interpreted in the New Testament. So mm-hmm. They look to they say that, oh, you're committed to a replacement theology, the idea that the church has replaced Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not Orthodox Christianity. The church and Israel is one people, one continuity. We had the Old Testament saints, New Testament saints.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's a continuity. Jesus has fulfilled the role of Israel,
mm-hmm.
but that's different. So many of the statements Jesus made, I am the vine, you are the branches, I am the light of the world, those were images which God used in the Hebrew Scriptures to describe Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel was meant to be the light to the Gentiles, to show, reveal God to the world. They failed.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Isaiah talks about Israel as God's vine. So when Jesus says, I am the vine and you are the branches, he's saying, you as a branch depend on me, not mm-hmm. the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see?
Okay.
So Jesus is central to our reading of the Hebrew and Christian Scriptures.
And going back into this conversation, where does the Christian Zionist stand on this two-state solution, and could it threaten the Bible's prophecy?
Christian Zionists don't subscribe to the two-state whatsoever, any more than a one democratic state.
Mm-hmm.
Their vision is a Jewish state, Jews-only state, maximizing the territorial land.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, certainly by 1940s, they were lamenting the fact that Britain had created Jordan
mm-hmm.
because they regarded what is now Jordan to be part of Palestine. It was part of Palestine when it was the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So they saw Britain giving away land to the Hashemites that should have been for the Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
So any idea that peace can be achieved through negotiating borders, territory, is anathema to Christian Zionists, because they believe God gave all the land to mm-hmm. the Jews, and therefore they oppose any giving up of land to the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
But their theology is based on misquoting the Bible, misunderstanding the scriptures, and showing no compassion or concern for the people who were living on the land before Zionism was imposed upon them.
Mm-hmm. And you know, as we're reaching almost like in this part, second part of this interview, I would like to ask more personal questions to you, Stephen. So just now we talk about the support to the Christian Zionists. I would like to ask you, what encourages you to be vocal against Christian Zionists?
When I was a young boy at school, I was quite skinny, and I used to get bullied quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's embarrassing, but I used to get bullied. I was thrown in the nettles. Mm-hmm. Nettles are stinging plants, and I'd be beaten up. And when you are attacked like that as a child, it's you develop certain inner strengths.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I deeply remember impacting me was that whenever I see someone else being bullied,
mm-hmm.
I can't walk by. I have to intervene.
Oh.
And that can be dangerous sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Jerusalem on one occasion, and there was a riot, and the Israeli soldiers were attacking Palestinian women, and I got my camera out,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, I'm not going to run. If I run, it sounds like I'm guilty. I'm going to stand my ground. So I've been in situations where, because of my upbringing,
mm-hmm.
I've felt I've got to do something. When I began to follow Jesus
mm-hmm.
and realized Jesus was persecuted
mm-hmm.
and he promised that if you follow me, you will be persecuted
mm-hmm.
for righteousness' sake. They will insult you. They might even kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I realized my name, Stephen, he was the first Christian martyr in the book of Acts. I realized that we're one breath away from eternity.
Mm-hmm.
What matters is that we serve God. So my burden for Palestine goes back a long way.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember my first degree was in geography, and I love geography. I love the way God has created this beautiful world, the diversity. And when I became a Christian, I wanted to travel to Palestine and walk where Jesus walked. I wanted to visit the holy sites because the land is the fifth gospel,
mm-hmm.
Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four gospels. But the land is like, it opens everything up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can walk on the Sea of, can't walk on the Sea of Galilee. You can go on a boat on the Sea of Galilee, or you can walk in the hills of Galilee. And you know, those are the hills that Jesus saw.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out with a naive view that I'm going to deepen my faith by you know, encountering the land. I realized it was a war zone. I met Zionists who were rude, who were carrying weapons, mm-hmm. who were aggressive, bossed me about. And then I met Palestinians who were friendly.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't terrorists. They weren't trying to steal my money. I remember one occasion I got lost in Bethlehem, and I went up to a stranger and I said, can you tell me the way to Nativity Street? He said, get in my car. And I thought, you don't do that in England. But he felt obligated to help a stranger, and that's the way you do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't say it's a second left, third right. They take you. They feel an obligation. I experienced the suffering of the Palestinians on their side of the wall, if you like. And then that motivated me to do more study into the origins of the conflict,
mm-hmm.
and how the Bible, and this is what made me really angry, was the way the Bible was exploited to justify racism,
mm-hmm.
supremacism, Zionism. apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me more and more determined to speak out on it. I wrote a couple of books. It got me into a lot of hot water. I was persecuted. But persecution is a bit like exercise, going to the gym. If you want to have
strong muscles.
Good muscles. How do you get good muscles? You exercise.
Yes.
What is exercise? Exercise is resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that in the early days, I would debate Zionists. They don't debate me anymore because my arguments have improved.
Oh.
It's through testing mm-hmm. that you refine and you gain strength and confidence. And that's why I'm passionate for Palestine. It's the birth of the church. It's the mother church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's close to extinction. And it's close to extinction because of the way the Zionists have an exclusive claim to the land. They've been, as you know, they've been bombing churches,
yes.
hospitals, not just mosques, not just half the homes in Gaza. They're mm. indiscriminate.
Not only the Muslim affected, but the Christian in the Palestine.
And if I was being controversial, and I am being controversial, Zionists want to portray this as a conflict, an eternal conflict between Jews and Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And given push to shove, Christians are more likely, sadly, to mm-hmm. side with Zionism over Islam. So the presence of an indigenous Palestinian Christian community that's been there 2,000 years is problematic for Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
They must either blame the Muslims for Christian persecution
mm-hmm.
or, well, the sooner they leave, the better, because then it's Christians will support Jews against Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So advocating, as we do, for Christian human rights organizations in Palestine, Sabil is one, Kairos is another, speaking out for them and with them is a way of challenging Christians, even here in Malaysia, that this is not a Muslim issue, this is a human rights issue,
yes.
this is an issue involving suffering to Christians and Jews and Muslims,
yes.
and that we have a moral and religious obligation to stand with anyone
mm-hmm.
calling for justice and peace on equal terms, equal rights,
yes.
sharing the land,
mm-hmm.
And not siding uncritically with racists,
mm-hmm.
with supremacists.
Mm-hmm. And if we could see on the narrative of the Israel, when they're trying to shift that this is an issue of religion, the war between the Islam and also the Judaism, I think in a way they portray it by, look at the Hamas, they are Islam. Does Islam portray it this way? And talking about Hamas, I'd like to ask your personal opinion. Why do some people refuse to condemn Israel's of its genocide?
The way that Zionists portray this as a conflict between Islam and Judaism is a smokescreen. It's a cover
mm-hmm.
for settler colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
They're using religion as an excuse to steal land.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically theft. They're stealing land. They're using violence
mm-hmm.
to threaten and to force people off their land.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using religion. That's blasphemy in my book. Now, in terms of why Christians particularly won't condemn what Israel's doing in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
sadly, the church, particularly in the West, is still saddled with guilt and fear. They are terrible burdens to have on one's shoulders, guilt for the past, fear of the future. You know, Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. God provides for the birds, to the grass which flourishes in the morning and is gone by the evening. How much more does he care for you? So trust him today and not worry about tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But Christians in Europe particularly have guilt for the Holocaust, for the way Jews were treated in Christian countries.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, for centuries, they were persecuted. And Zionists have exploited that. They constantly refer to the Holocaust. There are Holocaust museums all over the world.
Yes.
And I'm not in any way saying we should minimize the the terrible things that that happened during the Holocaust. But there comes a point where we have to say we must not allow the things that led to the Holocaust, i.e. genocide and ethnic cleansing and discrimination, wherever we see those steps to genocide, steps to the Shoah, the Holocaust, we must root it out before it's too late, before another racial group is wiped off the face of the earth. So guilt for the Holocaust. Second is fear of anti-Semitism. You know, I can remember when it was clear that anti-Semitism meant prejudice or hatred for Jews because they are Jews. Islamophobia is clearer. Prejudice, hatred, hostility to Muslims because they're Muslims. Both are racism. Yes. Both are wrong. Both should be condemned. But what Zionists have done in the last 10, 20 years is diluted the definition of anti-Semitism to include criticism of Israel. If you criticize Israel, you are anti-Semitic, because Israel is Jewish and therefore you're criticizing Jews.
Yes.
You see the sleight of hand. We've moved from one thing to another, and before you know it, you're suppressing free speech, because I can't criticize Israel because I'll be accused of being anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic. The first time you're accused of being anti-Semitic, it's terrible. It's like you feel it's on your forehead, it's been tattooed, everyone, you know, you're a racist. But when you know it's not true, when many of your strongest supporters are Jews, when you live with them and work with them in solidarity for Palestinian human rights, you know, I constantly say to my Jewish friends, look, is there anything I've ever said that you would be uncomfortable with that you think is anti-Semitic? Tell me, because I want to repudiate it. And they say, no, keep going, keep going. So those are the two things. I think Christians are afraid of being accused of anti-Semitism or fear for the Holocaust. We wrote to 110 Anglican bishops in the last few weeks and asked them whether they regard Israel as an apartheid state, because the Anglican Church in South Africa has declared Israel to be an apartheid state. Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, Amnesty International have all declared Israel to be an apartheid state. And we simply asked 110 bishops in a personal letter, do you agree, yes or no, and if not, why? We had 9 responses, even after a reminder. 2 were positive, 7 were negative, and 100 didn't even bother to reply. They're fearful of putting their heads up and saying, this is apartheid, this is racism, it's prejudice, and it's wrong, which is deeply, deeply regrettable that church leaders who do know, should know, and should be willing to give a lead. But it reflects where Britain and Europe are. Many of our political leaders are in the same boat. They're proud to call themselves Zionists. They will not criticize Israel. They condemn Hamas, but they seem to lose their voice when it comes to speaking out about what Israel's doing in Gaza. They talk about calling for a ceasefire, but they're not calling about restitution and punishment of war criminals. You know, it's hypocritical. We need to go beyond the calling for a ceasefire to look at why are the people in Gaza in the first place? They're refugees. Why are they refugees? Where are they from? Who caused it? And who's causing it now? So we need a just and lasting peace based on international law, either an independent, sovereign, contiguous Palestinian state alongside Israel on 67 borders, or one democratic state, as the PLO Charter says, equal rights for citizens, both Israelis and Palestinians, within one democratic state. But at the moment, Zionists do not want either. Christian Zionists do not want either. They are content with one apartheid state with fewer and fewer Palestinians in it.
They just want the Palestinians for themselves only.
In the mistaken belief that God, from a Christian perspective, that God will bless them because of it.
So it somehow justify their action because they're holding on to that, oh, this is the promise being made by God.
It's partly that, and it's partly tapping into racism. You know, racism is endemic mm-hmm. to all societies. Mm-hmm. I have two lovely Anglo-Chinese grandchildren and a lovely Chinese son-in-law. But I know even in China, when they lived there, they were regarded as different because their eyes were...
I see different.
They were, from our perspective, they look Chinese, but yes. from the Chinese perspective, they look like European.
Uh-huh.
So they are different, and mm-hmm. therefore they are treated differently. And I'm not going to make any comment about Malaysia and about the Chinese and the Indians and the Malays, but certainly in Britain, prejudice is there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ignorance and prejudice,
mm-hmm.
endemic... And that's one of the factors as to why in Britain they look at Israeli Jews
mm-hmm.
who have come from Europe, who've come from America. They're like us.
Uh-huh.
They're one of us. And therefore there's more sympathy for them than there is for those who look different, who speak different,
mm-hmm.
who have a different religion, sadly.
So in a way, do you agree that racism plays a big role in how people respond to the issue?
They won't admit it, but mm-hmm. it's there. It's like an earthquake zone.
Mm-hmm.
It's invisible mm-hmm. in a society until there's a tension, and then it comes to the surface.
Yes.
And you hear someone say something, and you think, where did that come from? You know, they make a flippant remark. I mean, there's a debate at the moment as to whether within the royal family in Britain there is racism
mm-hmm.
Because of the way that... Prince Harry's wife and the children have been treated,
yes.
you know, and it's like front page news. Well, it's not that important what someone said to someone else
mm-hmm.
a decade ago. Mm-hmm. What matters is what's happening now in Gaza.
Mm-hmm. So it is still happening or not. And in a way, just now when we talk about the racism to the Christian support towards the Jews, do you think that is there any other underlying factor of it?
The history of colonialism, European colonialism, has always been to subjugate indigenous peoples
mm-hmm.
and maximize the stripping of their assets.
Mm-hmm.
If it's oil, coal, cotton, tea, mm-hmm. coffee, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
To either steal it or buy it for the lowest price possible
mm-hmm.
and benefit from it commercially. So there is a commercial element to colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
And Israel has developed modern high-tech industry, security industries, mm-hmm. weapons industries,
mm-hmm.
And likes to advertise the fact that its weapons are field-tested in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's crude, but that's how they do it. They sell products that we want, and we want to sell products to them. So there is a...
Economic factors?
There's an economic factor, but there's also a strategic intelligence factor.
Mm-hmm.
And one has to acknowledge that the Zionist lobby
mm-hmm.
is very strong
mm-hmm.
in America and in Europe. It's very hard to find a politician, certainly in Britain, who will speak out critically of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly in the States,
yes.
There's virtually unanimous support for Israel within Congress and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of one-sided support for one country against other countries is unhealthy and is a dangerous foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been heartening to see that as a consequence of the failure of the Abrahamic Accords, Saudi Arabia and Iran have been talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, countries that are next to each other
mm-hmm.
that have been cast as enemies, one Shia, one Sunni, based on the dividing line between either with Moscow or the US,
mm-hmm.
Actually realizing we need to sort out some of these issues between ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I see that as a healthy development.
And as we are reaching the end of this interview, Stephen, where do you predict the future effort to bring peace to Palestine? How can we unite to support the Palestinians without considering our backgrounds?
Someone said the definition of a pessimist is an optimist with information.
Mm-hmm.
An optimist with information becomes a pessimist, because the more information you have, the more pessimistic you become. So at one level, I fear there is worse to come. We've seen terrible, terrible things in North Gaza. We are, as we speak, in a time of ceasefire, but we're still dealing with days. And it seems the clear intent, Israeli intent, is to begin bombing southern Gaza. And it's anticipated that they will not allow Palestinians back into northern Gaza. The plan seems to be to expel as many Palestinians as possible into Egypt to become refugees. Mm. It's part of the continuing Nakba. We see it in the West Bank, intimidating villages, intimidating farmers, forcing them off their land because they want an exclusive claim to the land. Mm-hmm. So I'm pessimistic at that level. We have a number of other regional actors on the wings. We have Hezbollah having made promises that it won't allow Hamas to be defeated. Mm-hmm. At what point will they intervene and to what extent? Mm-hmm. The U.S. Navy is waiting in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf to respond. And will that escalate to turning Lebanon into another Iraq, turning Syria into another Iraq? What will Iran do if America does this? If Hezbollah does that, if Israel does that, the potential for escalation is very strong. Mm-hmm. So I'm praying that God will intervene and bring justice without more deaths and bloodshed. Mm-hmm. But knowing human nature, I fear that things will get worse before they get better. Mm-hmm. Having said that, from a theological point of view, from a faith point of view, I make two more comments. Quite often people give me a book and they say, I've read this book, you must read it. My wife sometimes does it. I'll tell you what I do. I read the last page. Mm-hmm. And if I like the last page, I might read the book. But if the heroine dies, what's the point of reading a book when you know what's going to happen at the end? Uh-huh. Well, the last book of the last page of the book of Revelation, which is the end of the Christian scriptures, talks about the heavenly Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, the new Jerusalem, where the gates are open 24 hours. There are no gates locked. And it talks about the tree of life back in the Garden of Eden, bearing fruit every month, 12 harvests, not one, not two a year, but 12. So continual supply of food. And then it says, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Mm-hmm. So this vision of the future, God's vision of the future on earth, at some point in the future, the nations still exist. Mm-hmm. The nations are being healed. And the vision is of a great multitude of people that no one can count, of every language, from every tribe, from every people. Mm-hmm. So if that's the vision of where we're going, it puts in context what's happening now, and it means that we take renewed hope in a God of justice and a God of mercy who calls us to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. Mm-hmm. From a Christian perspective, we, as Christians, we have been called to be ambassadors of reconciliation. Now, where does an ambassador serve? An ambassador does not serve at home. He serves on foreign soil, sometimes on enemy soil. Mm-hmm. That's where we should be. We're on earth, but this is not our home. This is not our place of security. We are representing God on earth as his ambassadors on foreign soil, because heaven is our home.
Yes.
And we've been called to be peacemakers, not widow makers. Mm-hmm. So, God forbid, whatever happens in Gaza next, whatever happens as a consequence, we must focus on our calling and mandate, which is to be ambassadors of reconciliation, peacemakers, knowing that without justice for Palestinians, there will be no peace for Jews, for Zionists.
And with that being said, I would like to thank Reverend Dr. Stephen Robert Sizer for his insight onto this topic, who is Christian Zionist and why do they support Israel?